it's Sangha Day. Opportunity to celebrate the Sangha, celebrate us. Who better to celebrate? So it's one sort of festival in the year when it's really great that the Sangha can be here, get together, really affirm ourselves, if you like, and our connection through history with the Buddhist tradition. So it would be great if lots of people came on Sangha Day. The main bit of Sangha Day happens in the evening, and that is a puja in the evening, in which Mitras of Last Ordination and order members will reaffirm the commitment they've made, and everybody else will get an opportunity to reaffirm the commitment to Buddhism. But also anyone who contributes to the centre, which is just about everybody, will sort of get an opportunity to express, make an offering as part of, you know, sort of symbolising that contribution that people make. It'd be a great evening, actually. It'd be a great evening. So please do come to the puja. That's a thing where, you know, it'd be really great to have as many of the Sangha as possible. Starting at 7, I believe.
The puja starts at 7.
So the puja starts at 7. In the afternoon, there are various events in the afternoon which you should have been informed about, but one of them is a Sangha cabaret. What fun! What fun!
And
so don't be shy. You've all got talents. Show them. Come. Dude, we need some more comedians. We particularly need comedians. Somebody said, well, it's a bit serious, so. No, we need. But whatever you can do, please volunteer to give us a turn of some sort on the Sangha Cabaret. So if you want to approach somebody who looks like they know what they're doing, which rules me out. There's a huge flip chart paper where you can write your name. I think the community is going to do something, I'm informed, is that right? Well, you are now.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. The men's community.
Sorry, old. Hush my face, the men's community. Well, would you like to do something?
I'm working, sorry. We're all
Please do offer to give us a turn on the Sangha Cabaret. Something just to flag up, we're sort of taking bookings for the winter retreat at Duke's Barn, so if you'd like to just give us your name if you want to go on that.
Come and see me at the tea break if you want to put your name down.
Or myself or somebody. So, really great this evening to have Vajracharya back with us. So there might be some of you who don't know Vajratara, but Vajratara was just a very big figure in Sheffield Buddhist Centre for a very long time, and very much part of what's made the Sheffield Buddhist Centre the way it is. And she was then invited, much to our loss, tragically, invited to go and join the women's ordination team at Tiruvannamalai, which, in view of her youthfulness, was an expression of how much she's appreciated around the movement, that she should be invited to join the ordination team. So we're really lucky to have Vajratara with us, and as those of you who have, remember Vajratara being here will know, which is most of us, she gives great talks. If you weren't here the last 2 weeks, our theme for this coming season is called the refuge tree, which is extremely difficult. The refuge tree of the Triratna Buddhist order, which is extremely difficult to summarise very quickly. But it's a symbol. And it's a symbol of how the Dharma reaches down to us. It's a symbol of our connection to something beyond ourselves. and how that something beyond ourselves got down to us. So it's got the Buddha in the very middle of it, and it's got an awful lot of other teachers who've been very important in the transmission of the Dharma down through the ages, and it's got archetypal figures, and it's got our own teacher, Sangharakshita. But it's got the Buddha at the very centre, so the Buddha's at the very centre of the refuge tree. And tonight, Vajratara is going to talk to us about the three aspects of the Buddha.
So, yeah, the refuge is very complicated to explain, so I'm really lucky because I've just got the Buddha. And everyone pretty much knows who the Buddha is, so great. So the good thing about in the refuge tree, the Buddha is right in the centre, and he's the biggest figure. Both metaphorically and often in depictions of the refuge tree, he's the biggest figure, literally. And he's the central figure as well, so he sits right in the middle, and he's the figure from all the other figures on the refuge tree come from and dissolve back into. So he's very much the sort of pivotal point of the refuge tree. So he's the most central figure, and indeed of all of Buddhism, he's the most central figure. But in the way, the Buddha is the hardest figure to get to grips with. And it's not because there's a lack of information about the Buddha. There's tons of information about the Buddha. But because the Buddha himself is a bit of a mystery. And sometimes the Buddha can feel very far away indeed. I'm assuming that everyone here has been on a beginner's course, and if we still do it the same way, which I'm sure we do. One thing we look at in the beginner's course is we look at the picture of the Buddha at Padmaloka. And one thing that people really love about that picture is it appears to be dissolving into light. It doesn't have very fixed boundaries. In a way, it's quite a mysterious sort of picture in the Buddha. And I think it's interesting that that's such a kind of popular picture of the Buddha, because it gives that sense that we don't really know who the Buddha is. He's a bit of a mystery. And in a way, the Buddhist tradition is divided into the Buddha, the Buddha's teaching, and the Buddha's community, the three jewels. And often it's the other two jewels that people get first. So if you say to people, what's the jewel? What's the most important thing in Buddhism for you? They usually say either the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, or the Sangha, the community, which practices the teaching of the Buddha. And in a way, they get Buddhism, but they get Buddha the last of all those refuges or all those jewels. And I think that's definitely true in my experience. It took me a long time to really feel for the Buddha. So why is the Buddha so hard to connect with quite often? I think it's because we don't really know where to start. So do we start with the fact that the Buddha, as it said, was born as we are born? Do we connect with the Siddhartha Gautama, who lived 2,500 years ago in northern India? Or do we connect with the image of the Buddha? There's many images of the Buddha. You know, you can buy them everywhere. You can buy them in TK Maxx. Actually, you can buy... Oh, I better get some product. You can buy some very nice Buddhas in Evolution, which make very appropriate Christmas presents.
Yes, they would.
Yes, they would. So, you know, maybe it's that. Maybe some people are really drawn to this figure of the Buddha, who expresses so much positivity and contentment. And beauty, yes, and beauty. So maybe that's who the Buddha is. That's who we connect with. Or perhaps it's to do with his enlightenment. You know, we're very connected with this idea of someone who awakens to reality, who awakens to the way things are. Maybe that's the Buddha. You know, maybe it's got nothing to do with Siddhartha Gautama. Maybe it's got to do with us. Maybe it's our innermost potential. So in a way, the Buddha isn't easy to work out. Which is the Buddha? Is it the Buddha Siddhartha Gautama, who lived 2,500 years ago? Is it the image of the Buddha that you can get in Evolution for a reasonable price? Or is it the reality itself? Is it insight into reality itself? Which I suppose is also a reasonable price, considering beginner's courses are free. It's a really bad joke for me, I can tell. So I was thinking about looking at the Buddha in these three different ways. And I was thinking, well, in a way, all of those are true. And what happens when you're trying to understand the Buddha is you're attempting to look at something with three different faculties. You're attempting to look at the Buddha with your head, with your heart, and I'll make this very, saying this very poetically so no one gets me into trouble, but with your soul. I know we don't have souls in Buddhism. So it's more like with your deepest sort of spiritual intuition. So you're trying to look at the Buddha from different angles, or it's almost like you're trying to look into a room that has three different windows, using very, very different parts of your being to see. You know, do you use the intellect? Do you try and work out who the Buddha was in history? Do you try and use your heart? Do you feel your way into the Buddha? Or do you use your sort of innermost spiritual sense, that sense of your own potential to look at the Buddha? So in a way, this kind of these three different ways of looking at the Buddha became to develop into a teaching of the three aspects of the Buddha, or even sometimes called the three bodies of the Buddha. So I put up the Sanskrit. The first way of looking at the Buddha is the Nāmanakāya, which means it literally means like the created body. But really it means the Buddha of history, the Buddha that walked, you know, the earth. A few of us went to India in February on a pilgrimage, and we walked where the Buddha walked. So, you know, he did exist, that kind of sense of the Buddha. Then there's also the Sambhogakāya, which means literally the body of mutual enjoyment, which is really the Buddha of the imagination. It's the Buddha that you see with your heart, the Buddha that you bring to mind. In your imagination. And also the Dharmakaya, the Buddha of reality, literally the Buddha of truth, the body of truth. That's beyond all kind of form, beyond history, beyond space, beyond time. So what I'm going to do this evening is look at those three aspects of the Buddha, and in a way how we can approach those three aspects of the Buddha. So let's start with the Buddha of history. And starting with what we know. So we do know that the Buddha existed. Well, actually, do we know that the Buddha existed? I'm going to ask myself that question. Anyway, we believe that the Buddha existed. He actually lived 2,500 years ago, as I said, in northern India. And we have a lot of records of his life, particularly written down in Pali, in the Pali canon, but also worked out in later versions in sutras called, so for example, the Lalita Vistara Sutta. So we've got lots of stories about the life of the Buddha. And we know a few things about him. We know that he was born as the son of a local ruler. We know that he asked questions about life. He thought deeply about life. He asked certain questions. He saw certain things about the way people live their life. He saw certain things about the way people interact with each other and exist. And we know that he left home while still young, instead of following the career that his father had set out for him. So his father expected him to take over as the ruler, but he left home to undertake a wandering holy life. So he became a wanderer. He took up with certain teachers. He became very accomplished in meditation, but it wasn't enough for him. And he ended up going on his own, leaving his friends, going on his own, sitting under the Bodhi tree, and doing a meditation in which he woke to the way things are. He gained enlightenment. He saw reality. And we know that he spent the rest of his life building a sangha, building a community, teaching, walking around northern India, trying to show other people the way to the truth. So we know all that's the kind of potted history, and it gives us some sort of sense of the Buddha, but does it tell us enough about who the Buddha really was? Does it really give us a feel for the person of the Buddha? And in a way, I think discovering the Buddha is not necessarily a kind of linear, worked-out process. You know, the more facts you find out, you know, the more you know about the Buddha, and you need to know this first and then that. I think what actually happens is that these stories of the history of the Buddha and what the Buddha might have actually done in life circle around the person of the Buddha. They don't really see him full on directly, but they give us a sense. They kind of give us an indication of who he might be. But they don't give us it all. They don't really, really say what it's like to be with the Buddha. We know from the early accounts of the Buddha that sometimes it was just the Buddha's presence, just a few words from the Buddha, and people gained insight into reality. They became enlightened. And we hear all these stories. We hear exactly what, you know, the Buddha must have said, and we wait for that big moment to arrive, and nothing happens, or at least it hasn't happened to me yet. And in a way, because we don't really get, it's not like we're really with the Buddha, like those people who are really with the Buddha. We're not quite there yet. And in a way, yes, these stories are circling around the Buddha, but they're not giving us a sense of who he is completely or directly. I was looking through some old videos not so long ago in Tiruvannamalai, and one of the videos that we've got is, which you've probably got here actually, is a video of Dado Rinpoche, who was Sangharakshita, who founded this order. He was Sangharakshita's teacher. And at one point, the interviewer says to Sangharakshita, says to Dado Rinpoche, is Sangharakshita a Rinpoche? Is he a great Lama, basically? Is he a great Buddhist? And Dado Rinpoche thinks a minute, and he says, I don't know if he's a Rinpoche. But he must be a great spiritual teacher, because look at his effect. He says, look at his teachings and look at the order that he has founded. And he said, when you see a smoke in the jungle, you know there is fire. And in a way, I think it's the same for the Buddha. What we have is the smoke in the jungle, and we know that there's a fire. And when you see the smoke, when you see the stories of his interactions with others, when you see, when you hear about the qualities of the Dharma, when you start practicing the Dharma, when you see the qualities of the Buddha's followers, you know there's a fire in the jungle. You know that there's a center point of all of this, which is really quite incredible. So I'm going to look at those sort of three smokes of how we can see the Buddha of history. So the first is, we can see the Buddha of history through his stories of the interactions with others. And sometimes we read a story and it just grabs us. There's a lot of stories. The Pali Canon, particularly, I find, is a wonderful thing. And it has a lot of just accounts of his meetings with others. And it's not that there's, you know, sometimes you come across a particular story and it's not necessarily the most worked out, it's not necessarily the most famous, in a way it could be quite short, but something grabs you about it, something gives you an indication of who the Buddha was. There's a quote by the poet Yeats where he says, "Wisdom is a butterfly, not a gloomy bird of prey." And in a way that has to be our approach with reading the stories of the Buddha, like a sort of a delight, a light delight in certain stories. And sometimes we just dwell on something. Sometimes we find it going round and round our mind. I suppose it's another way of saying sometimes we just really enjoy a particular story. So I'm going to tell you a story that I particularly enjoy, which I think gives us quite an indication of what the Buddha must have been like. So the setting is in Sarvati, as some of us have been to. And the Buddha's sitting outside of an evening. Actually, it might have been quite late at night. It was dark. And he was sitting outside with his companion, Ananda, who'd been with him for many, many years. And they were probably fairly old men by then. It was in the last portion of the Buddha's life. So he was sitting with his dear, dear friend, Ananda. And he turns around and he says to Ananda, "Do you approve of Sariputta?" Now, Sariputta was also another great dear friend of the Buddha. He was the Buddha's chief disciple. And we do get from the stories of the Buddha and Sariputta that they had a lot of mutual affection and regard and even love for one another. So the Buddha turns around to Ananda and says, "Do you approve of Sariputta?" Which is quite an interesting thing to say, because it's a totally, he knows that Ananda approves of Sariputta. Sariputta is the Buddha's chief disciple. He's not going to turn around and say, "No, actually." So he just says, "Do you approve of Sariputta, Ananda?" And Ananda says, "Well, Indeed, who would not approve of the venerable Sariputta unless he were foolish, full of hatred, deluded, or mentally deranged? Good answer, Ananda. He says, Sariputta is wise, he's content, he gives and receives advice. And the Buddha says, so it is, Ananda, so it is. And the Buddha starts rejoicing in the merits of Sariputta. So you get the impression there's these two old men, they've known each other for ages, and they're rejoicing in Sariputta's merits, who isn't there, who they both really love. They just love Sariputta. There was no reason to rejoice in Sariputta's merits. There was no object to it. He wasn't giving a teaching. He just felt, in this moonlit night, like rejoicing in the merits of Sariputta. And then something rather exciting and strange happens, which is a deva called Susima comes down and with a great assembly of young devas. Now, devas are kind of gods, basically, or angels. So I'm not going to go into the metaphysics of whether angels or gods exist. You're just going to have to bother someone else with that. It's a story. Just enjoy the story. So, all these, basically, this whole great, vast assembly come of angels or devas come up and light up the whole of the park where the Buddha's staying. They just light it up with their incredible beauty. And they all start to rejoice in Sariputta's merits. So they're all just rejoicing with the Buddha and Ananda about Sariputta. And it's said that the devas were so happy to be rejoicing in Sariputta. They were elated, they were gladdened, they were full of rapture and joy. And they start glowing with brighter and brighter colours. And it says in the text that they were like jewels shining on a brocade cloth. They were like ornaments of gold. They were like the morning star. Or they were like the sun rising on a clear autumn day. And they just radiated light. And they say, they start singing to the Buddha about Sariputta. They say, he is widely known to be a wise man, Sariputta, who is free from of anger, a few wishes, gentle, tamed, the seer adorned by the teacher's praise. So there we go. There's a little story from the Pali Canon. And I think what's interesting about that for me, anyway, is just the delight that the Buddha had in rejoicing in his disciples. He wasn't some sort of cold, distant, sort of sage old man, you know, who just sort of stood on a platform or a stage and just sort of nodded sagely. He loved his disciples. His idea of a great evening would be to just sit there rejoicing in someone who wasn't actually present. And however we might interpret the kind of deva or the angel figures who come into this text, in a way to me it indicates a sort of upwelling of energy and inspiration, of beauty and joy. So we get the picture that the Buddha was a very joyful man. He enjoyed rejoicing in others. He was very happy and inspired. And the more he became inspired, the more people around him became inspired. And then they start to glow and shine in different colours. So yes, that's one story. So it's little stories like that where we just get a little indication of who the Buddha was, a little snippet about what it might have been like to be with the Buddha. So the other thing, way we get to know the Buddha is through his teachings. So there's another story of the Buddha where he's wandering around in northern India. It looks like he's wandering on his own this time. And he comes across a potter's workshop. And he thinks, well, this is a suitable place to stay the night. Because remember that the Buddha was a beggar. So he needed the generosity of others to find a place to sleep. And he goes up to the potter and he says, could I stay in your workshop for the night? And the potter says, yeah, that's fine, but there's already a wanderer in there, so you might just have to ask him if it's okay to stay there. So the Buddha walks in and he finds someone there, Pukkusati, it turns out. And he says, do you mind if I spend the night here as well? And Pukkusati says, no, that's fine, friend, come in, you know, make yourself at home. Maybe he didn't say that.
He shouldn't.
This is a sort of Yorkshire version. So he says, come in, friend. Some ancient Indian courtesy. And actually what they do is they don't make a cup of tea or sit down. Actually what they do is they sit in meditation. So the Buddha, first of all, they just both sit down in meditation for most of the night. And they're both sitting there absolutely still in meditation. And the Buddha thinks, actually, you know, this guy's got something. This is quite, you know, there's something, he's very into his practice. He sort of takes an interest in this wanderer, Pukkhasati. So when they finish meditating, he turns to Pukkhasati and he says, he said, friend, who's your teacher? And Pukkhasati says, well, it's the Buddha. And I've gone forth, I've entered the Sangha, the Buddhist community, and I'm practicing the teachings of the Buddha. And the Buddha says, oh, right, okay, so would you know the Buddha if you saw him? And Pukkhasati said, no, unfortunately I've never met the Buddha, and so I wouldn't know him if I saw him. Buddha says. And he says, okay, would you like to hear some Dharma? Would you like to hear some teachings? So Pukkhasati, oh yes, thank you. So the Buddha starts teaching him about a particular meditation practice called the six element practice. And as he's talking, you sort of get this sense that Pukkhasati suddenly realises that this is no ordinary teacher. And then at one point it just dawns on him, you're the Buddha. And then he says, I'm really sorry because I called you friend. And he prostrates himself at the Buddha's feet. And he says, the teacher has come to me. It's a lovely moment, actually, because you can imagine, you know, this wanderer, he's following the teachings of the Buddha. He's never met him. And he suddenly realises the teacher has come to me. In my lifetime, I've met the teacher. I've met the Buddha. The teacher has come to me. But it's a very interesting moment, because how does he know he's the Buddha? Well, he knows he's the Buddha through the qualities of the Dharma. It's through hearing the Dharma that Pukkhasati knows who the Buddha is, that he can finally see the Buddha when he reflects on the Dharma. And I think this is the route for a lot of us, actually. I think what happens is, first of all, what we do is we put the teachings of the Buddha into practice. We take them to heart, and we know that there's a fire behind them. That's when we take an interest in the Buddha, because we think, who is it? Who is it who gave rise to these teachings? Who is the person who could have showed such an understanding of human nature? Who could have been so relevant, even though he was talking 2,500 years ago? Who could have really seen what life was about and made a difference to my life. You know, and I certainly have felt that way. I've put the teachings of the Buddha into practice, and I think, wow, he must have been extraordinary. What an extraordinary consciousness to really get down to the root of life so that someone in my time and in my culture could really benefit from those teachings. And it's that that gave me an interest in the Buddha. Who was the fire behind these teachings? Because it is incredible that it could have survived so long, you know, even starting out as an oral tradition, it could have survived so long and even been relevant to me here and now. So that's another way we know the Buddha through history. We know the Buddha through his teachings. And we also know the Buddha through the quality of his followers. In a way, it's the Sangha that also indicates the qualities of the Buddha. And there's a record of that process happening at the time of the Buddha. There's a story of King Pasenadi. And the King Pasenadi is an old man, and he's 80, and it's also said that the Buddha was 80 at this time. And so the king's an old man. He goes away on business. And he's been all day in negotiations, and he's very tired. So he asks to be taken to a pleasure garden. And if you've been to India, just imagine it's like some of those old parks that is very very still and very peaceful. You know, there's the kind of chaos of the marketplace or the street, and you go into these parks, and there's these big trees where you can sit underneath the trees. Very, very, and out of the kind of peace and the noise. And if someone hasn't picked them and sold them, there's lots of flowers. So, you know, beautiful flowers. So he asks to be taken to a pleasure garden for some rest. And it says that King Pasenadi starts wandering through the trees. And he starts looking actually at the roots of the trees. And as you might remember, roots of trees can be really beautiful. And there's some big trees in India where the roots kind of come out of the ground. And, you know, they make these beautiful kind of curved shapes. And he looks at these roots of trees, and it's so, he says, it's so lovely and so inspiring to see these trees. And this park is cool in the heat of the day, and it's silent and it's peaceful, and it's away from voices. That's what he says, it's away from voices. So you can imagine that the king has been in negotiations, and, you know, all the kind of political wrangling that goes on, the power games and people trying to kind of con each other. And he says later that he's often interrupted, so he's getting away from the interruptions. And he goes to this pleasure garden, and it's so beautiful, so peaceful. And he looks at these roots of trees, and he starts feeling very, very inspired. And he says to his attendant, he said, this is the kind of place that the Buddha and his followers would really like. They would really like to meditate here, I think. And he starts remembering the Buddha. He remembers days sitting with the Buddha in parks like these, in the cool of the trees, such as these trees. He remembers talking about the Dharma with the Buddha. He remembers it was in places like these that he could revere and honour the Buddha. And he starts to become very happy and inspired. And he says to his attendant, well, what I'd really like is to go and see the Buddha, actually. And the attendant says, well, actually, you know, the Buddha's not said to be not so far from here. So the king says, well, great, okay, saddle up the elephant. And another thing that the Buddha didn't actually say. To say about the elephant. So he goes off on the elephant with his retinue, all his ministers and his guards and all the pomp and ceremony. He goes to find the Buddha. It's about 20 miles away, I think. And he comes to the park where the Buddha's staying, and he gets off his elephant, and all the kind of entourage sort of, I think they just stay behind, and the Buddha goes on foot to see the Buddha. So the king goes on foot to see the Buddha. And he gets to this park, and there's just these monks wandering up and down, very still, very silent, in walking meditation. And the king goes up to one of them and says, could you tell me where the Buddha's staying, and would I be able to see the Buddha? And the monk turns around and said, yeah, that's fine. He's staying in that hut over there. You just need to go up to the door, knock and cough. So the king, you know, there's no kind of like, yeah, I'll go and get him for you. The king's here, you know. So he goes up on his own, knocks on the door, and I'm here. And the Buddha opens the door and sees the king. And the king prostrates at the Buddha's feet and starts covering his feet with kisses. Covering the Buddha's feet with kisses. And he says, I am King Passanadi of Kosala, Venerable Sir. I am King Passanadi of Kosala, Venerable Sir. And the Buddha he says, why such homage? Why such honour and friendship, King? And the Buddha says, the king says to the Buddha, he says, well, I honour you because I get a sense of who you are because of your followers. He says, the reason I honour you is because your followers never give up. They live the spiritual life as long as breath lasts. They never give up. Other wanderers, other religious mendicants, they give up. You know, you see them living a spiritual life for a certain number of years, and then you see that they're married with kids and doing something over there, or quarrelling and arguing and gambling. But, you know, the followers of the Buddha never give up. They never start gambling and quarrelling with each other. They live the spiritual life as long as life and breath last. And he says, the followers of the Buddha live in harmony. He says, you know, I'm a king, I see lots of quarrelling. But actually, the followers of the Buddha, they live in harmony, and they view each other with kindly eyes. And he says, you know, I see a lot of wandering mendicants who just look really miserable. And they're really scraggy and scruffy looking and thin and a bit, you know, a bit crazy looking. He says, but the followers of the Buddha are smiling and cheerful, sincerely joyful, plainly delighted, their faculties fresh, living at ease, unruffled, content with what they have. So they're happy, basically. They just look happy and inspiring. They don't look all sort of miserable and thin. It's good to start my personal thing about, you know, let's be happy, joyful Buddhas. Let's eat more. I don't think the Buddhist should be thin. He should be quite plump. So yes, they're smiling and joyful and cheerful. And they're well disciplined. He says, you know, I'm the king and I have the power of execution over people. And yet, when I'm in a meeting, people talk over me, they interrupt me, they don't listen to what I'm saying. And, you know, I sometimes say to them, look, I'm the king and I've got the power of execution, so I think you should listen. And they still don't listen to me. They still interrupt each other and talk over each other and not listen to what I say. He says, but the Buddha, what you can have with the Buddha is you can have several hundred people sitting in absolute enraptured silence when the Buddha's speaking. And they listen completely attentively, without making any noise, without any interruptions, talking over each other, without any coughing, without clearing their throat. It's just silent and people are really delighted and just listening. He said, and if someone does cough, another monk just turns around and says, shh, the Buddha's talking. And he said, it's amazing. Even I as a king don't have that kind of power. And he says, you know, I went on a journey recently and I have two attendants. And I give them their wages. It's me who employs them. It's me who brings them wealth and fame. And yet, I noticed recently that when they went, when we went away travelling and they set up their lodgings for the night, they spent nearly all of the night talking about the Dharma, talking about the Buddha's teaching. And when they went to sleep, they slept with their heads towards the Buddha and their feet towards me. And he said, and it's me who employs them. It's me who gives them their wealth and fame. And yet it's the Buddha that they respect. And he says, that's why I have confidence in the Buddha. That's why I know that the Buddha is fully enlightened. So it's a very interesting way of looking at the Buddha. He knows the qualities of the Buddha because he can see the qualities of the Sangha. And I think that's what's interesting also about the image of the refuge tree. You have lots of teachers of the past and present sort of arranged around the central figure of the Buddha. And in a way, when you read their lives, when you understand their teachings, when you see what they've gone through in their lives as Buddhist practitioners, you know who the Buddha is. You start to wonder, well, who is the fire in the jungle? Who is the fire in the centre of all these people? Who is it that unites all these people from all these different cultures? So that's true of the teachers of the past, that we look at all these Buddhist practitioners, and the more we know about their lives, the more we know about the Buddha himself. But I also think it's true of the Sangha of the present. I think sometimes, you know, it's not like the Sangha of the present is completely perfect, but you know that people have got something. And sometimes you go to the Buddhist centre and you think, well, you know, this is a bit of a disparate group of people, but they've got something. There's something going on here. Maybe you find that people at the Buddhist centre are quite attentive and kind and wise. But actually, yes, and it gives you a sense, well, who is it? What is it that unites them all? What gave rise to this kind of quality of attention that you find in a Buddhist centre? I definitely found that, actually, when I was younger. I was really on the lookout to see what these people were like. And I never thought they were going to be perfect. But there was some sort of special, undefinable quality. And maybe that came from the Buddha himself. So I think that we, as a Sangha, to the extent that we're followers of the Buddha's teachings, we indicate what the Buddha's qualities might be. In the language of that particular sutta, that particular discourse that I was just relating, we become monuments to the Buddha. We become sort of testimonies to the Buddha, monuments to the Buddha, the smoke that indicates the presence of the Buddha. So I think, you know, to the extent that we practice the Buddha's teachings, that is quite a responsibility as well, particularly if you're ordained. So yes, so that's the Buddha of history, and we get to know the Buddha of history through his stories of his interactions with others, the teachings themselves, and even the qualities of followers of the Buddha throughout the ages. And when we get a sense of the Buddha who lived, who actually existed in history, Something happens. We become emotionally involved. In a way, our heart is lifted. And the Buddha becomes not just a historical being of mild academic interest, but something that speaks to our innermost longings, our innermost desires. We resonate the Buddha with the Buddha. And in a way, we see that in a way, he is us, or at least he is us in potential. So going back to this story of King Pasenadi, he goes to a place that moves him. He goes to a place that's beyond his usual worldly preoccupations. He goes to a place that's beyond all the chatter, all the deal-making, all the posturing, all the worldly whims. He goes to a place of beauty. And in that place, he is reminded of the Buddha. And he imagines the Buddha. And the Buddha represents something far more than just the man that he has often talked with. The Buddha represents something deep within the king. Maybe his spiritual values. Maybe the Buddha represents what's the innermost longings of the king, or the spiritual desire of the king that's beyond worldly preoccupations. So that's in a way the journey that we've all got to do. We've got to find a place, in a sense, that reminds us of the Buddha, and go in finding the Buddha in our own hearts, using our imagination to really imagine the Buddha. So imagination has got, actually Vidanya gave a talk about this recently, but I'll just sort of recap a bit, that imagination, the word imagination in the English language has been denigrated to just mean something made up, or fantasy, something a bit irrelevant, you know, something that you just put together in your head. But actually for Sangharakshita it can be much more than that. He calls it a power or capacity of the individual, having in it something that is more than the individual, that transforms the objects of experience and unifies them. So what imagination is to Sangharakshita is a faculty that we all have, that we can all develop and utilise, but it's something more than ordinary consciousness. So what ordinary consciousness does is it's sort of self-focused and limited, and it just sort of reorganises sensory experience in terms of what can I get out of it. So ordinary consciousness just divides things into grasper and grasped. What can I get out of this? Here's me. What does this situation mean for me? What can I get out of it? So when you see something like the Buddha, you just see him as a sort of interesting historical character. And, you know, maybe there's something that makes a bit of sense to me. But, you know, he sort of remains sort of out there as just, you know, what can I take from the Buddha? Whereas if you see the Buddha with imagination, it transforms the information to help us make real sense of our experience and points beyond the experience itself to the reality that lies behind it, something deeper, something that's sort of more essential about reality. So we don't just look at, say, the Buddha as, you know, well, there was this bloke in India and he might have something to say, he might not. And do we know he existed anyway? We don't see it in those kind of utilitarian terms. We see the Buddha as representing the principles that shape the universe itself. We see something much more than the Buddha. We see the Buddha as pointing towards something in ourselves. So in the deepest seat, if we'd like to use that language, in the deepest seat of the king's consciousness is the Buddha. And it's under particular conditions that he's brought back to that. He's brought back to the Buddha. And the Buddha represents much more than someone he knows. He comes to symbolise what is found in the cool and the quiet and the beauty. He comes to represent for the king what the king values most in the world. Beyond the worldly preoccupations, what the king really values in the world is represented by the Buddha. In a way, it's the jewel in the forest, the jewel in the forest of the king's imagination. There is something really precious. So that when the king is in a certain condition, he remembers what is most precious to him, what is most essential, what is of deepest value in his own being. He's reminded again of his own potential and what's best in himself. Because it's the king himself who's dialogued with the Buddha. So when he remembers the Buddha, he remembers the best moments in his life, the moments of most value. He remembers what's best in himself and the conditions under which he was at his best. And unlike the king, we can't just then go and see the Buddha and go and take our elephant or our chariot or whatever and go and see the Buddha. Literally, but we can in our imagination. So we too can leave behind our ordinary preoccupations, our struggles and our pettiness and our conflicts. And we can stand outside the Buddha's hut and we can cough and knock. And in a way, when we do that, when we try and see the Buddha, what we're trying to do is get in contact with what we value most in the world, what's of deepest importance to us, spiritually speaking. And when we leave behind our worldly preoccupations and go and knock on the door of the Buddha, what we're doing is we're showing an attitude of supreme receptivity to what is highest and best in ourselves, what is of most value in the universe. And in a way, that's what I imagine myself to do in meditation. What I'm really doing in meditation is I'm leaving behind the world. I'm going inwards. I'm going to find the Buddha. And I'm knocking at the Buddha's door and I'm clearing my throat. There's a beautiful verse in the poems of the early Buddhist nuns where a teacher says to her disciple, "Go and see the golden teacher with his golden skin, who tames the wildness of our minds and is enlightened, unafraid." And actually, I say that verse every time I meditate. Go and see the golden teacher with his golden skin, who tames the wildness of our minds and is enlightened, unafraid. So that's what we do in meditation. We go to meet the Buddha. We knock on the door. And when the Buddha appears, we cover his feet in kisses. Because to see the Buddha in our imagination, we must love the Buddha. And the reason for this is that we all love something. And what we love, we imagine. And what we imagine, we move towards. And most of the time what we do is we imagine our desires. So if we're not imagining enlightenment vividly and powerfully, and moving towards that, we'll be imagining our fantasy house. We'll be imagining, I don't know, sex. We'll be imagining what we're going to have for dinner. We're going to be imagining what we're going to do with our lottery money when we win it. We're going to be imagining samsara in all its forms, and we'll be moving towards that. So that's what we do. What we love, we imagine. What we imagine, we move towards. And if we're not imagining the Buddha, if we're not loving the Buddha, then we're going to imagine something else. So if we're really going to move towards the Buddha and see the Buddha in our imagination, we must love him. It's almost like the Buddha has to become a bit of an obsession. The Buddha says at one point, he says, craving is overcome by craving. So craving for samsara is overcome by craving for the Buddha. We've got to have, it's actually the more literal translation would be, thirst is overcome by thirst. We've got to have a thirst for the Buddha, a real delight in the Buddha, a kind of powerful craving for the Buddha in order to become the Buddha. So that's what we do in our imagination. We've got to evoke a sense of beauty and wonder and sort of intensity in order to really see the Buddha in our imaginations. There's a recent paper by Subhuti called Reimagining the Buddha. And he says, there is a deeper issue going to the heart of what it is to lead the Dharma life. Unless we can truly imagine the Buddha and his enlightenment in a way that stirs us deeply, we cannot mobilize our energies to go for refuge to him. We can only imagine the Buddha wholeheartedly by discovering his image in our own minds, inspired and supported by the images around us. So that's when we do what we do when we're trying to imagine the Buddha, is we look at all the images, we look at all the stories, we get all we can know about the Buddha, and we let it stir us deeply. We let it inspire us. We let it help us discover the Buddha in our own minds. We let it help us discover the Buddha that we love and we can imagine. And maybe the Buddha in our own minds is going to be imagined in different ways. Maybe the Buddha won't come out as, you know, a man in northern India 2,500 years ago. Maybe he'll come out as the golden teacher with his golden skin. I think it's a very important poem, actually, because it was written at the time of the Buddha, and yet already the Buddha was becoming something more than the Buddha. He was becoming the golden teacher with his golden skin. Maybe when we start to really imagine the Buddha, he will become a bit more Western-looking. Maybe he'll become the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, and male and female. In a way, we've just got to start that process happening. And the way we start that process happening is, like the king, we've got to go deep within our own minds. We've got to knock on the door and wait. And we've got to have our hearts open and be ready to love what we find. And one of the important things about this process is to not worry whether it's real or not. So to quote, I think what's probably a modern Buddhist discourse, Harry Potter, Kate's benefit, who's reading this for the first time. At one point, Harry Potter turns to Dumbledore and he says, "Is this real or not?" And Dumbledore replies, Harry Potter says to Dumbledore, "Is this real or has it been happening inside my head?" And Dumbledore turns around to Harry and he says, "Of course it's happening inside your head, Harry, but why on earth should that mean that it is not real?" So yes, of course, there's lots of things that's just going to happen in our head. We're going to imagine the Buddha, and it's probably going to be nothing like what the Buddha was 2,500 years ago. But why on earth should that mean that it isn't real? Why, just because it's in our head, should it mean that it's not real? So that's what we do. We journey in. We go into the forest. We go into the cool of the trees, into the quiet and the stillness, and we go to find the Buddha. And the more intensely we do that, the more, in a way, we intensely love what we can become. We see the Buddha as our own potential. We see the Buddha as what we value most in the world. And the more we love that, the more we love everything that the Buddha represents, the more we open ourselves up to the mystery. So in all mystical traditions, it's love that is the last veil between us and reality. And in sort of creating those sort of warm emotions, we start to get to what the Buddha is beyond even the form of the Buddha. We see that the Buddha is beyond us yet ourselves, to quote Wallace Stevens. So in the Buddha of the imagination, we see something of the Buddha that resonates with our own experience. We engage with the Buddha as something real and possible and relevant, and something within us, something that echoes our own spiritual values, something that we want to base our lives on, something in us that corresponds with the Buddha, something in us that resonates with the Buddha. But we also need to envision the Buddha as beyond us, because the Buddha is a mystery and he's completely beyond our current understanding. He's even, we could say, completely beyond our framework of understanding. He's beyond words and concepts. He says of himself at one point, he says, "I'm neither a god nor a man." So usually we try to think of, you know, we try to box people up in certain categories. And we say, well, the Buddha was just a human. He was just like us. You know, he was just some bloke who was born. He did a lot of spiritual practice. He had this really overwhelming experience and he taught others. So he was just like us. He was just a man or a woman. Human, anyway. So, yeah, he's just like us. He's just a human just like us. But, you know, really, really positive, really ethical, really on the ball with his meditation, really wise. But he was a human being. Or we say, actually, the Buddha's a god. You know, if you go to Southeast Asia, if you go to India, if you go to Buddhist countries, you start thinking, well, the Buddha must be a god because everyone's making these offerings to him. They're praying to the Buddha. So he must be god. He must be a sort of god figure. And often in our culture, that means that we just reject him because we can't quite see the Buddha as god. So we just push him to one side. But actually, the Buddha said, well, all your ways of categorization don't work with me. There's no way, there's nothing that you know in the world that could be used to categorize me. I'm not a god, and I'm not a human being either. all those ways of telling have been removed. There's no way that you can, in your ordinary experience, that you could pin me down. So the Buddha is completely beyond us. He's the mystery. He's the great mystery that we'll only know when we ourselves become enlightened. And I think if the Buddha of the imagination is evoked by love, the Buddha of reality is evoked by wonder or even fear. I sometimes get a sort of notion of great fear. I've sort of based my life on the teachings of this person and I don't know what it means. So the Buddha of the imagination is evoked by love, but the Buddha of reality is evoked by awe and wonder and a sense of being completely out of your depth. He's beyond us, yet ourselves. So just to sum up, seeing the Buddha, I think, is a bit of a journey, and it'll take a long time. It's not something you can easily pin down. And it starts with looking at the Buddha in history. And you get a sense of the Buddha through the stories about him as a person, through his teachings, and through the behaviour of his followers. And something in those stories grabs you. Something takes your interest, alights in one of those stories, or a teaching. And you're stirred deeply. And you see in the Buddha something of yourself, something of deepest value in yourself. You see in the Buddha the best of yourself or yourself in potential. You see in the Buddha your highest values personified. Beyond the worldly preoccupations, something that resides deep in your imagination. And then the Buddha starts to represent something about reality itself, beyond you yet yourself. And this is the paradox of the spiritual life. Seeing the goal of the spiritual life is a great mystery and beyond you, and yet attainable and real. And I think to really start that journey, you need that combination of boldness and humility. So boldness to think you can become the Buddha, and humility to realise you have absolutely no idea what that means. And maybe if you can take on that paradox of boldness and humility, you can see the Buddha. And if you can take on that combination of boldness and humility, seeing the Buddha as beyond you, yet yourself, you can go and see the golden teacher with his golden skin, who tames the wildness of our minds and is enlightened, unafraid.